Okay, well, welcome. My name is Richard Clem, and welcome welcome to our Elimination of Bias portion of the program. We're doing a live conference call today on May 27th, and we are also recording this program for the podcast listeners who are taking the on-demand program. For those of you who are taking it live today, I have your attendance all recorded, so you don't have to do anything further. But for those of you listening to the podcast on some other date, during each portion of the program, I'm going to give two code numbers. I'll give one toward the middle of the program and one toward the end of the program. It's just a letter. Actually, the letter will start with B for bias, and it'll be a three-digit number following that. So write down those numbers. And then email those to me at the end of the program, and I will use that to take attendance and make sure that you get proper credit for either Minnesota or Wisconsin or probably some other states as well. So welcome to today's program. Today's Elimination of Bias, this is the first hour of a two-hour program talking about the subject of elimination of bias in the Minnesota court system and in the legal profession. And I start this program out by quoting here in the materials a couple of rules governing the topic of bias, just to remind us that it's not just kind of an optional topic, something we should feel good about, something we should think about occasionally. But I just want to remind us that there are some actual rules. We're going to cover a little bit of substantive law, things that we are required as attorneys to do as legal professionals. Those rules are, first of all, in the rules of the district courts in Minnesota, and I'm sure most other states have a similar rule. When we're in court, the rule simply says that when we are in court, we have to treat everybody fairly, we can't discriminate while we're in court against anybody on the basis of race, color, creed, religion, national origin, sex, marital status, sexual preference, status with regard to public assistance, disability, or age. So at least when we are in court, we can't discriminate against anybody else in the courthouse, witnesses, parties, other attorneys, on the basis of any of those grounds. That governs us when we're actually in court. Other times, either when we're in court or when we're on the job or even sometimes when we're off the clock, the Minnesota Rules of Professional Conduct also tell us that we're not supposed to be biased, because we are, first of all, prohibited while we're on the job from harassing people on any of those same grounds. When we're working from 9 to 5, we're not allowed to harass anybody on the basis of their race, color, national origin, and so forth. I guess you're not violating that rule if you harass somebody when you're off the job, although you probably shouldn't do that. But the other part of the rule actually covers us 24 hours a day, and that is if you violate any federal, state, or local anti-discrimination law, whether or not you're on the job. That is also a violation of the rules of professional conduct. So I quote those rules just to remind us that it's not just an optional topic. Yeah, bias is a topic that we are supposed to talk about. Now, the other rule that I do not quote in the materials is a rule that you're undoubtedly familiar with from your mere presence here today, and that, of course, is the rule of the Minnesota Board of Continuing Legal Education, saying that we need 2 hours of elimination of bias credits. So we're going to talk a little bit about that rule, about the history of that rule, and also the fact that it's been a little bit of a controversial rule over the years. So we're going to talk about that a little bit during the course of the program. Now, I always start this program by reminding us that I am not in any way whatsoever an expert on this subject any more than either of you are or that any other attorney in the state of Minnesota is. I don't pretend to be an expert on the subject. So first of all, those of you who are taking the program live, if you do have any comments or questions, feel free to jump in with them, because every time I've given this program, I've learned a lot from doing it. In fact, when the when the Minnesota Supreme Court was talking about whether or not to amend the rules to allow on-demand programs, one suggestion I made was that the elimination of bias program maybe should be excluded from that, because like I say, I'm not any more of an expert on the subject, and also I've discovered from taking other programs, the other presenters who have given the program are not really any more experts on the topic than the other lawyers in the room. So I've actually learned a lot more from these programs from the other lawyers in the room than I have from any kind of official presenter, including myself. But the Supreme Court did not adopt that rule, so that's why some of you are taking this program by way of the podcast. Like I say, feel free to jump in, even if you're not taking the program live today. If you do have any comments, please let me know, because I learn every time I give this program. In fact, I might even ask you to join one of my live programs in the future. And speaking of which, if you do have any questions, the rules require me, and I would do this anyway, to answer any questions that you might have after the program. So if you do have any questions about today's program and you need to contact me, the fastest and easiest way to do that is usually by email to clem.law@usa.net. And I promise to answer any emails in the time stated by the rules, which I think is 24 hours. So I'll get right back to you if you have any questions about it. Or feel free just to give me a call too. That's sometimes the easiest way to do it. My phone number is 612-378-7751. So if you have any questions or comments, feel free to let me know what they are. Today we're going to be talking about a little bit about the history of this elimination of bias requirement. And as you know, it's been a little bit controversial over the years. In fact, I've always been a little bit in the camp of thinking that why do we need to take these 2 hours of bias? What good does that do? You're not going to eliminate anything in the course of these 2 hours. And besides, I don't know any lawyers or any judges in the state who are racist or overtly biased or anything like that. So why should I have to spend my time doing this? Well, I'm not the only attorney who's thought that. And I've come around a little bit after giving the program a few times. First of all, because I have an economic interest in it. You are all paying me to take your elimination of bias credit. So I guess for that reason, I think it's a good idea now. More so than that, I have learned from presenting this program quite a few times that there probably are some things we can learn to make ourselves a little bit better attorney in the process. So I think it's an unrealistic expectation for us to think that I'm going to eliminate anybody's biases today, because first of all, I'm probably just as biased as any of you are. So I don't think it's a fair outcome to say that you're going to walk away from today's program totally unbiased. You're going to be a different person. But like I say, I think at the very least we'll be able to recognize some of our biases a little bit better, and recognize that we have some biases, and in the process be able to compensate for those biases a little bit, and in the process probably be able to serve our clients a little bit better, to be able to understand them a little bit better, to be able to understand the people we're interacting with in the course of the legal profession. So we have to be here for these 2 hours anyway, whether it's part of this live program or whether you're driving to work in your car listening to the podcast for these 2 hours. Either way, we have to be here, so we may as well make the best of it and try to learn something. So that's the way I approach it. The history of that rule really dates back to about 1993. Because in that year, the Minnesota Supreme Court decided to take a look at the question of whether or not there is racial bias or bias against different groups of people within the Minnesota court system. Now, like I say, I've always been in the camp a little bit of being a skeptic about whether or not there is bias. Because, like I say, I know a lot of attorneys I've interacted with many attorneys, and I have yet to meet one of them who I would say, ah, that person is a racist. It just hasn't happened. And I certainly haven't met any judges who I think are biased or racist or anything like that. So for that reason, I've always been a little bit in the camp of the skeptic, saying, oh, why should we have to waste the taxpayers' money looking into bias in the court system? Because I can tell you there isn't any. Or be one of the skeptics to say, well, why should I have to take my 2 hours of elimination of bias? Well, what the Minnesota Supreme Court did back in 1993 was they appointed a task force, and it was headed up by then-Justice Rosalie Wall. And we'll talk about her in a minute. But they took a hard look at the question of whether or not there is bias in the Minnesota court system. And in order to do that, what they did was they conducted public hearings throughout the state and also looked into written materials. But, I mean, the main focus of it was just going out and doing listening sessions, listening to members of the public, holding hearings, just asking members of the public, tell us about your experiences with bias in the Minnesota court system. And at the conclusion of that process, they published a 355-page report, which is published on the Minnesota Supreme Court website, and you can look at it there. And they detailed their findings, telling about bias in the Minnesota court system. Well, the skeptic like me looks at that report, and me, the skeptic, I have to look at that report, and I have to conclude that, well, maybe there is something to this bias thing. Because a lot of the observations that they have, they really have the ring of truth to them. Some of them are correct. I mean, I think there are a few things in there we can point at and say, yes, that's definitely bias in the court system. That's something we have to fix. A larger part of them, I don't know if you can quantify it, but at least some of them, some of those observations found in that report, I think the skeptic like me can look at those and say, ah, those people think that the system is biased against them, but they're wrong. There really is no bias. They're just imagining this particular kind of bias. And in some cases, I think that argument is actually correct. You know, I think some of these things, and we'll look at some of the particulars later on. I think some of them we can take a look at and say, they're wrong on that. That kind of bias simply does not exist. Well, it's easy to dismiss those for that reason. So we can just tear out those pages and throw them away because those people are wrong when they said that. But I think that's a mistake to do that because when you look at these observations that were made all over the state by different groups of people, many of the same observations come up over and over throughout the state. So I think we have to concede that at the very least there is a perception of bias in many quarters with respect to some parts of the court system. Even if that bias is not actually there, at least there's that perception of bias. Well, it seems to me that that perception of bias is really just as bad or maybe even worse than actual bias within the system. Because we as lawyers depend on one thing to make our livelihood, and that is that in general most people have at least a certain amount of respect for the rule of law. In this country, most people recognize, sometimes a little bit grudgingly, but most people recognize that we are a government of laws, and that the laws in general are fair. Not always, but most of the time the laws are fair, and that if you have a dispute with somebody, in general, if you go to court, you're going to get a fair hearing about it, and you're going to have your day in court, and our court system, our judicial system, calling the police or suing somebody in civil court, in general, that's perceived as a good way, as good a way as any of resolving our disputes. So if you have a dispute with somebody, you take it to court. And in the process, you and I are employed as attorneys, so we take advantage of that system. Well, if you have a large number of people thinking that the system is unfair, well, then eventually the system is going to break down because people are going to try to figure out other ways of redressing their grievances rather than using the court system. And in addition to just from a point of view of being good citizens, that's probably not a good thing to happen. We have a you know, we have a financial stake in that because we as attorneys earn our living from people having respect for the rule of law. So I think even in those areas where we could look at these observations made by people and conclude that, well, there's really nothing to that. Those people are just wrong. Even if that's true, it's still an area of concern for us, and it's still an area that we should take a look at. And at the very least, it's an area where we should do something to cure those perceptions so that if our system really is fair, if our system really is unbiased, then we want to make sure that we communicate that to people so that people are aware of it. So like I say, looking at that 355-page report, I have to grudgingly conclude that, well, yeah, there is something to it. There is something to the subject of bias in the court system. The other thing, you know, like I say, that was 20 years ago, 1993, 21 years ago at the time this is recorded. When I look at that 355-page report that came out way back when, I can look at some portions of that, and I can pat myself on the back as one of the attorneys in the state, and I can pat our court system on the back and say, you've done a great job of eliminating this bias that was identified by this group of people. That problem is solved. And there are a few parts of the report where we can say that. We can be proud of how far we've come in the last 21 years. Unfortunately, though, there are only a few such pages. Because most of that report that was written in 1993 really could have been written just as easily yesterday. And in fact, the things we're going to be talking about today are ongoing reports where the court has continued that process of looking into bias in the court system. These have been done in the last couple of years or so. And we'll see that most of the things that are coming up now are pretty much the same things that came up in 1993. As far as I know, we have this elimination of bias requirement in our rules of continuing legal education, kind of in perpetuity. I don't know, in 100 years, will we still need to be talking about 2 hours of elimination of bias? I don't know. I think that that requirement is really just as relevant as it was in 1993, that we should talk about the subject of elimination of bias. Well, two things happened as a result of that 1993 task force. They published that report that got filed away. The two things that happened was the main thing that was done to solve that problem, or one of the things that was done, was this elimination of bias requirement that was imposed in the rules of continuing legal education. So that's why we're here today. It all dates back to that 1993 report. And then the other thing that they did, like I mentioned, was that they did continue this process. They didn't just file the report away. They've had an ongoing process of holding listening sessions throughout the state, where they go out and simply ask members of the public to tell about their experiences with bias in the Minnesota court system. So what we're going to be talking about for the bulk of the next 2 hours is what was said during those listening sessions, when members of the public were asked to tell their experiences about bias within the court system, within the judicial system, within the legal profession. We're going to talk about some of the observations that they made. I kind of grouped like topics together, and I didn't really put them in any particular order. But two things stand out. First of all, most of the observations that are made, it doesn't really matter where they are made. So in other words, Native Americans in Hinckley generally say the same things, a lot of the same things that African Americans in Minneapolis and St. Paul are saying. And they say the same things that Somali immigrants in Rochester are saying. So a lot of the observations that are made are the same everywhere. So it's not just one isolated person's grievance. There are recurring threads that keep coming up. And the other issue that kind of struck me was, I just mentioned Somali immigrants in Rochester. Well, in 1993, I think the attorney in Rochester would have been on pretty solid ground, or an attorney in Duluth or Mankato. I think they probably would have been on pretty solid ground if they said, why should I have to take 2 hours of elimination of bias? Because we don't even have anybody here against whom we can be biased. So, so what's the point of that? That's a problem for the Twin Cities to worry about. And I think they would have, like I say, that would have been a pretty strong argument because, and this is kind of unique to Minnesota, because another question that comes up is, well, why do attorneys in Minnesota have to take elimination of bias and attorneys in other states don't have to? Well, one kind of interesting thing that I've noticed about Minnesota is that, with one exception, we'll talk about them in a minute, but with one exception, we really didn't have any minority communities outside the Twin Cities area. There's a large African American community in Minnesota. There's a large Hispanic community. There's a large Asian community. There are all kinds of different communities, but in general, most of those minority communities have been in the Twin Cities, and in fact, in particular, in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Because until, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, there was really zero African American population in Rochester or Duluth or Mankato or areas outside the Twin Cities. And one thing that is kind of unique to Minnesota, because most other states, what really drove that home to me, I never really noticed that until I gave this program one day in Mason City, Iowa. We as Minnesotans kind of think as Iowa as being kind of, the same general background as Minnesota. Yeah, we tell Iowa jokes, but we kind of think of ourselves as Midwesterners with a lot in common. But there are differences in the culture between the two states. And one of them I noticed was one attorney in Mason City, an older gentleman, so he probably went to high school in the 1950s, he was relating an experience about his days as a football player for Mason City High School. And the subject came up because he was telling about an experience where a fellow football player on the Mason City football team was African American, I think he was talking about something where they actually on a road trip they wound up his friend wound up in a different hotel because they were in a city with segregation. I think he said when they went to Nebraska, so the black football player actually had to stay in a different hotel from the white football player. So he was telling that story. And it was an interesting story in its own right. But the thing that stood out to me was that there was a black football player on the Mason City football team in the 1950s. Well, I don't think that would have been the case for a comparable city in Minnesota at that time. So one difference between Minnesota and other states that we makes it maybe a little bit more difficult for us to grapple with some of these issues is that in Minnesota, we have never really had a rural minority population. So that is one thing that makes us a little bit different. Now, as I noted, there's one exception to that, and a pretty important exception, because one community that's been in the state longer than it's been a state or even a territory is, of course, the Native Americans. There have been Native Americans in Minnesota long before there were white people here, and that is, and now they're both in the Twin Cities area, but historically they've also been all around the state. So that is one issue that I would have told the rural attorney in 1993 that, it might have some relevance to you because don't you have Native Americans where you live? So the issue of bias would have been relevant. But what has changed in the last 20 years after that long introduction to the subject, what has really changed since 1993 is that there are now minority populations in different parts of the state. Because 20 years ago, if you do a LexisNexis search for the phrase Rochester Somali community. Well, I doubt if you're going to find any results from 1993, because there was no Rochester Somali community. There really wasn't any kind of community in Rochester other than, white middle-class people. But now that has changed very much. Now, in 2014 or maybe 2015, when you're listening to this, there's a Somali community in Rochester. There probably was in 20 years ago, but maybe not 30 years ago, in West Central Minnesota, a pretty large Hispanic community. One friend had an interesting story that he was going to school. He was in seminary to become a pastor, and he was off on internship out in some little community in western Minnesota. And he was one thing he was recounting. His wife was Asian. His wife was from Japan, I believe. But one issue that comes up is if I'm going to live in a small town in western Minnesota, where can you buy Asian food in that town? Because 20, 30 years ago, that would have been a real problem, because there probably wasn't any place to buy Asian food in that area. Well, it turns out that today there is a place where you can buy Asian food, because there's a large Asian community, and that is in Walnut Creek, Minnesota. Is it Walnut Creek where Laura Ingalls Wilder was from? I think it was Walnut Creek. But anyway, that little town where Little House on the Prairie was set. You can't think of a more quintessentially white farm community than that. But it turns out that small town has a large Asian community. And the reason for that is 20, 30 years ago, when the Hmong refugees were resettled in the United States, they wound up in cities, and generally that meant St. Paul, Minnesota, or I think Fresno, California. They're very concentrated in those areas. And they were a very rural people, so understandably, after they got settled in here, one of the things that they wanted to do was return to a rural lifestyle. One of the elders in that community was kind of tasked with the idea of figuring out where they were going to move. Well, it turns out he didn't know very much about rural America either, other than he had read and enjoyed Little House on the Prairie. So he was familiar with Walnut Creek, Minnesota, and he figured that would be a good place to move. So he moved to Walnut Creek, Minnesota, and many people followed him. So today, 30 years ago, Walnut Creek, Minnesota would have been a white Protestant community, very homogeneous. But today, it's half white Protestant and the other half Hmong. For that reason, it's the place in that part of the state where if you want to go buy Asian food, that's the place to go and buy it. So that's one thing that's really changed since 1993. Is that if you're an attorney in outstate Minnesota, these issues are of more relevance to you than they probably were then. You have to worry now about things like diversity and bias and things like that. Whereas 25 years ago, well, maybe you didn't have to worry about those quite so much. So that's one thing that has changed over the years. But like I say, when you read that 1993 report, some of the things have changed, but as you'll see from the observations we talk about today, not a whole lot of those things have changed. One sidelight before we jump in. I'm good at making long introductions here. So the first time I gave this program, I was hard pressed to fill up an hour talking about it. And as you'll see in our next 2 hours here, I won't even get through all the material then. So in fact, for those of you who are taking it live tomorrow, if there are any particular parts you want to cover, please let me know and make sure I get to those, because otherwise I probably won't get through all of the materials. I mentioned that this 1993 task force was headed up by Justice Wall, Justice Rosalie Wall, and she passed away last year in 2013. And as I read some of her biographies, and I think I included in the course materials for those of you taking it live today, I kind of just put them on the web page. For those of you on the podcast, I think I'll revise the course materials and include a link to a biography of her. But the one thing that struck me upon reading her biography after she passed away was I realized she was probably very, very well suited to head up this kind of task force, to look into the question of bias in the court system, because she was obviously a participant, or I don't want to use the word victim, but she obviously felt the effects of bias in the court system, and that was and it's interesting to see how closely, in many ways, her biography tracks that of Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. They actually had a lot in common, even though they're very different politically. Obviously, Justice Wall, I think, was kind of in the liberal end politically, whereas Justice O'Connor was much more conservative politically. But they had a great deal in common, and as pointed out from their initial appointments to the bench. Justice Wall was appointed by Governor Perpich in 1977, and she was the first woman to serve on the Minnesota Supreme Court upon her appointment in 1997. Justice O'Connor was appointed by President Reagan several years later, I think it was in the mid-80s, and she, of course, also served as the first woman justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. And in both cases, both of those justices, there was a certain amount of criticism at the time of those appointments because both Governor Perpich and President Reagan were accused, with a certain amount of truth to this accusation, that they made this appointment just because she was a woman. And like I say, I think that's true. I think Governor Perpich realized that it was time to appoint a woman to the Minnesota Supreme Court, because there had never been one in 120-plus years of the court's existence. And similarly, President Reagan recognized that there had never been a woman on the U.S. Supreme Court. So I think both of them, I think it's pretty safe to say that they both consciously made a decision that they should appoint a woman to that seat, and they sought out to find a qualified woman. The criticism, though, at the time was, well, you should have appointed the most qualified person for the job. You didn't appoint the most qualified person for the job. You appointed this particular candidate simply because she was a woman. So there was some criticism. And like I say, there's a certain amount of truth to that, because I think it's safe to say that they were appointed because they were a woman. I think time has proven those critics wrong, because even though their political views were probably quite different, I think time proved that Justice Wall and Justice O'Connor were indeed the most qualified person for the job. I think they both should be regarded as among the great judges of the 20th century. They were both excellent judges, and they well deserved that appointment, notwithstanding that criticism that they were not the most qualified person for the job. But the reason for that kind of criticism was that Justice Wall, she was, her background was an assistant state public defender. She worked for the state public defender's office, and I believe at the time of her appointment, she was teaching at William Mitchell. If you looked at objective criteria, well, you could probably come up with somebody who was more qualified. I don't know exactly what the tradition was in the 1970s for appointment of justices to the Minnesota Supreme Court, but I think if you looked at some of those prior appointments, I suspect you would have found within the ranks of the Minnesota Supreme Court at the time former judges of the district court who had been elevated, or former county attorneys, and she was neither. She was a former assistant public defender and a teacher in the in a clinical program at William Mitchell. So the accusation was, well, she's not the most qualified person for the job. Similarly, in the case of Justice O'Connor, well, when you appoint somebody to the U.S. Supreme Court, well, I guess, yeah, you want to appoint the most qualified person for the job. And who is the most qualified person for the job? Well, a pretty small pool. You pick former judges of the D.C. Circuit, or perhaps you pick a former Chief Justice of a state Supreme Court, or perhaps you go to Harvard or Yale Law School and pick one of their professors. That's traditionally where most of the judges of the Supreme Court have come from. Well, where did President Reagan go? Did he go to any of those sources? Well, no, he went to the Intermediate Appellate Court of Arizona, because Justice O'Connor was she wasn't on the D.C. Circuit. She wasn't even on a state Supreme Court. She was on the Court of Appeals of the state of Arizona, and she had held political office. She had been one of the leaders, party leader in the Arizona legislature, but she did not have the kind of credentials that are typically associated with judges of the Supreme Court. So there was the accusation, well, she was not the most qualified person for the job. Well, like I say, I think time proved them wrong in both cases, because I think both of them did prove themselves to be the best person for the job, whatever that phrase means. And, of course, that, you know, what does that phrase mean? But as a matter of fact, both Governor Perpich and President Reagan had to stoop down a little bit lower than they normally would for that appointment. But I think it's safe to say that was because both of those people had experienced barriers to hiring for women within the court system. In the case of Justice Wall, when she graduated from law school, she got a job at the Minnesota State Public Defender's Office. But the Minnesota State Public Defender at the time later admitted that he kind of purposely hired only women to staff the positions that came up in his office. Not because he had any idea of affirmative action or anything, but as he later explained, that was the best way to staff those positions at the lowest possible cost, because there were barriers to employment at the time for women. So at the time Justice Wall graduated from law school, if she had been male, she probably would have been snatched up by a big law firm at a large salary with which the State Public Defender's Office could not compete. But because she was a woman, that did not happen. So he had this large pool by deliberately looking to fill these positions with women. He was able to get good talent at a lower price than he would be able to otherwise. That's why she was a former public defender rather than a judge of the district court or a county attorney or in a major law firm. So when the governor had to pick the most qualified person for the job, well, he did have to look lower than he would have in the case of a male candidate. Similarly, in the case of Justice O'Connor, she when she graduated from law school, I think at Stanford, I don't recall if she went to Arizona right away, but she applied at major law firms and did not get any interviews at major law firms, with one exception. I don't remember if it was a firm in Phoenix or in California, but she was offered a job at one major law firm, but that was as a legal secretary. And even though she was way at the top of her class, she did not get a job offer other than that of secretary. Unfortunately, she didn't take that job. She held out for something better. But it goes to show that there's an accusation that that both of those appointments were not for the most qualified person. But like I say, I think time has proven them wrong. A long way of saying, I think Justice Wall was uniquely qualified to head up that committee. Before I forget, let me give that code word for those of you listening to the podcast. The first of two code words for this hour of the program is B107. B as in bias, 107. B107. B107 is the first code word. So like I say, at the end of the program, email me all those code words, and I'll use that to take the attendance. Well, anyway, after that long introduction, we will go ahead and jump into these actual observations that were made. Like I say, these observations come from listening sessions held throughout the state where members of the community were simply asked to tell about their experiences with bias in the Minnesota court system. Now, I take these here in no particular order, but with the exception of the first one, I put this one first because I think it's kind of an interesting way of looking at things. One issue that came up many of these places was, you need to educate and train your employees and the court staff, and this probably applies to us as private attorneys as well. You have to be educated and trained a little bit better on how to be courteous, compassionate, understanding, tolerant, and humble about racial and societal differences. And I think it's interesting that the word humble gets used there, because as attorneys, humility usually isn't something that we really think of as an important part of our job description. And in fact, if I want to hire one of you to be my attorney, I will probably not pick the person who I think is the most humble. I don't want a humble person representing me. I want an aggressive person representing me. So humility doesn't necessarily fit in with what we do on a day-to-day basis particularly well. But on the other hand, I think we should remember that there are times when, especially when you're faced with cultural and societal differences, sometimes a little bit of humility can really go a long way. And like I say, this issue came up at a number of listening sessions. They're phrased similar ways. But I think one anecdote that kind of drives it home the best was this one from Hinckley, where one of the elders of the tribal community, and the listening session in Hinckley was held at the casino there, and most of the participants in that program were members of the Mille Lacs Ojibwe Native American tribe. The observation that was made there, I thought was interesting, was one by a tribal elder who was recounting a story of a conversation he had with a sheriff's deputy, I guess deputy of the Pine County Sheriff's Office. And like attorneys, if you're, I don't know, it depends on what interaction I'm having with them. But in general, we don't want our police officers to be particularly humble. They have a tough job to do, and we want them, you need to do that job. Well, you need to be a little bit aggressive. You can't just be humble all the time. Otherwise, you won't be able to faithfully execute the laws very well. But sometimes, even though that's not part of your job description, sometimes a little bit of humility can go a long way. And the story he recounted was he was talking to this deputy, and the deputy was lamenting about one particular member of the tribe that had frequent contact with law enforcement. The guy wasn't necessarily in any trouble, but he was one of these people that was always crossing paths with law enforcement for one reason or another. He had to deal frequently with the cops, and the cops had to deal frequently with him, even though he wasn't particularly in trouble himself. But it was always a tense situation when law enforcement had contact with this particular individual. He didn't like talking to the cops, and the cops probably didn't like talking to him. So everybody was always on pins and needles whenever they, it was always confrontational whenever they had to deal with this guy. It just made a bad situation for everybody involved. Well, after hearing this this officer's sob story about having to deal with this this bad news guy, what this tribal elder suggested to this deputy, this gruff deputy, was that, well, next time you run across this guy, just try this. I won't do any harm. Just give it a try. just say Anin Buzu. Now, I'm sure that I butchered that when I said that, and I'm guessing that the deputy probably butchered it even worse than I did. But what I was trying to say and what the deputy was trying to say was simply the words hello in the Ojibwe language. So I can just imagine this encounter, the deputy saying, oh, yeah, right, you know, next time I see Mr. Bad News, these two magic words are going to do the trick. But this tribal elder said, oh, just give it a try, see what happens. So probably reluctantly, probably grudgingly, the deputy agreed that he would do that. Well, much to the deputy's surprise, that made a world of difference. That, you know, it wasn't, you know, nobody likes talking to law enforcement, but at least this this extreme tense situation, this extreme confrontational attitude was gone simply from the expedient of trying to say a couple of words in the other person's native language. So, so like I say, I don't. I want you to be good, aggressive attorneys, and I want you to, you know, zealously represent your client's interests. And that means sometimes being being aggressive. But on the other hand, sometimes when the situation calls for it, sometimes a little bit of humility really can go a long way. So, just something as simple as saying a couple of words in somebody else's language. One time I had a client, and this, I'm not revealing anything confidential about this because this would just be, it's a very common name. So it'd be like me telling a story saying I had a client whose first name was John. But I had a client, he was from a Middle Eastern country, and his first name was Aid, spelled E-I-D. And he came to me because he had some legal question or whatever. So anyway, he was sitting across the desk, and I said to him, hello, call him by his name, and look at what's spelled there. And the natural reaction, of course, is because I'm an English-speaking person, is, well, pronounce it in English. So the natural reaction would be to say, hello, Eid, E-I-D, because that's how you would pronounce it in English. But I made a lucky guess, and my lucky guess was that, well, it's not an English name, so probably not pronounced the same as it is in English. So I'm guessing it's two syllables. So I said to him, hello, Eid. And he practically fell out of his chair because I was the first American who had ever said his name right. So of all the time he had ever talked to Americans in this country, I was the first person in his life, the first English-speaking person who said his name right. And it was just amazing that tiny little gesture, partly because I got lucky and I guessed right about how to pronounce it. But just a little gesture like that really can go a long way. So like I say, you should, especially if you're my lawyer, you should be aggressive when you're representing me. But like I say, sometimes humility can really serve the purpose. So always keep that in mind. So that was the first topic that was brought up at many of these listening sessions. The other ones are a lot more specific. So we'll start talking about some of those now, and probably only get to a couple more in this hour of the program. But the first issue that came up in a lot of parts of the state was that people don't understand the court proceedings. So once again, people were asked, well, tell us about your experiences with bias in the court system. And they invariably come up with these stories that, I think the system was biased against me because I didn't understand what was going on when I went to court. It was just totally alien, everything going on. I had no idea what was transpiring. And sometimes that can have very bad consequences if you don't understand what's going on. I think I don't know if it's in here, but one of the stories that came up was somebody who they were pleading guilty to some criminal offense, or they were found guilty or whatever. And anyway, the judge was rattling off the conditions of probation. That judge, understandably, is rattled off these conditions of probation 1,000 times before. So it's kind of rote, where he's reading from the paper in front of him, listing all the conditions of probation. But one of the conditions of probation in this county was that before you leave the courthouse, you're supposed to go down and check in at the probation office. So the judge rattled off these conditions of probation, and condition number 37 was, before leaving the courthouse today, you shall report to room 107, the adult probation office. Well, the for whatever reason, the defendant did not hear that or did not understand it, and then after the case was over, they walked out of the courtroom. They went home and they promptly got themselves arrested for they violated their conditions of probation 5 minutes after being placed on probation. But their argument was, "Well, I just didn't understand. I didn't know I was supposed to do that." And you see, there are a lot of stories like that about people not understanding the system. Now, the skeptics out there could very well chime in at this point and say, "Aha! But what does that have to do with bias?" Because bias has nothing to do with it. That person was just, not being personally responsible and not paying attention. Even if they didn't understand what was going on, that had nothing to do whatsoever with their race or their nationality or anything like that. Well, you'd probably be right, because if I were in that situation, I probably wouldn't understand either. If I were a criminal defendant, it would be kind of an overwhelming experience. And I might miss it when the judge tells me to report to the adult probation office before leaving the building. So it might have nothing to do with bias, but two things to keep in mind. Three things to keep in mind. Even if it doesn't have anything to do with bias, well, we still want people understanding what's going on. So even if it has nothing to do with bias, if that's happening all over the place, maybe that's something we want to make sure we maybe try to fix. But again, though, there's that perception of bias people were asked, tell us your experiences with bias, and this is what they talked about. So at the very least, there's a perception of bias out there that we need to keep in mind. So like I say, even if it's not actual bias, there's a possible perception of bias out there. And the other thing too is that even though much of this might not have anything to do with any particular bias, well, there's sometimes it might. There might, some of that misunderstanding might come from language and cultural factors. Now, the language factors we'll talk about later in a different part of the program, because obviously if the judge is not speaking your language, well, then maybe you won't understand what's going on. So like I say, we'll talk about that separately. But some of it might be cultural factors too. In fact, the one comment that came up in amongst the Native Americans, and perhaps that would be probably true in other cultures as well, is that a lot of our communication is nonverbal, and I probably have a pretty similar background to most of the judges in this state, kind of a typical white middle class upbringing. So I know those conventions about nonverbal communication. So, for example, if I get accused of a crime and I decide, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go throw myself on the mercy of the court. I'm going to plead guilty, and I'm smart enough that I know that when I stand there and plead guilty, I ought to show some remorse. And hopefully the judge will take my remorse into consideration when sentencing me. Now, even if I'm not remorseful, well, I still want to go through the motions and show some remorse. So, how do I show remorse as a white middle class person? Well, I've been taught that you show respect to people who are talking to you, and the way that you show respect to people who are talking to you is one way you do that is by looking them in the eye. So when the judge is admonishing me for the horrible thing that I did, one way I show remorse is by standing there and listening to him while he talks to me, let him get it out of his system, all the time looking him in the eyes. And hopefully he'll see that remorse and maybe be a little bit more lenient when it comes time to sentence me. Well, if I came from a culture that expresses that remorse in a different way, there might be a miscommunication there. And the subject that came up apparently amongst Native Americans, and I think this is true in a lot of other cultures too, in some cultures you show respect to somebody, you show deference to somebody in a position of power, not by looking them in the eye, but by looking down. So if I'm a Native American apparently, and I'm not just pretending that I'm remorseful, I'm really remorseful. The way I do that is by showing respect for the judge by looking at my feet while he's talking to me, and I'm actually showing respect. You know, the you know, that guy is really remorseful. I was just, you know, putting on an act, but I pulled a fast one on the judge. But this guy is really remorseful, but he's not showing it in the right way. So he is not going to get credit for showing remorse as I would. So like I say, even though maybe some of these not understanding court proceedings have nothing to do with it, well, they're might have nothing to do with bias. Well, some of them might, but even those that don't, we should probably something we should be a little bit concerned about. In our remaining 4 minutes here, I guess we'll talk about a subject. Well, maybe we'll pick this up again tomorrow in part two of our bias program for those of you taking the podcast, because it's a pretty big topic. We could talk about it for a long time. Employ people of color, and we talked about that a little bit. In reference to, well, not people of color, but people of a different gender, because in 1977, if a woman was asked about, tell us about your experiences with bias in the court system, she would probably say, well, I haven't seen any female judges. Well, there were female district judges, but not on the Supreme Court, and probably not too many district judges either. So we've talked about that issue a little bit. In our remaining 3 minutes here, I guess the observation I'll make here is that, like I say, I approach this, I'm kind of conservative politically, and I approach this when I see something about, heading here, it says employ people of color, I think, aha, they're talking about affirmative action, and I'm opposed to that, I'm against that. And I am, to a certain extent. But on the other hand, there is something to this, and it was explained to me best by an African-American attorney who took this program a couple of years ago, and he asked me to do a little thought experiment. And what that thought experiment was as follows. I live in Ramsey County, and I don't know the exact ethnic makeup of Ramsey County, but I am white, and I suspect that, I don't know, maybe something like 70% of the population, or something like that, of Ramsey County is white, like me. So, therefore, when I go to court at the Ramsey County Courthouse as an attorney or as a litigant or whatever reason I'm there, more often than not, most of the judges are going to be white because they like me, are residents of the county. Most of the court staff probably works in the same general area, so I would reasonably expect that maybe about 70% of the judges are white. Man, probably not exactly that same number. Maybe it's 60%, maybe it's 80%, but most of them are white. So if I go to court and I see a white judge or a white juror or a white court clerk, I don't think anything of it, of course. Similarly, though, I realize that a large percentage of the population is of different colors. So I'm not surprised. I don't think anything of it if the judge is of a different race, if he's black or if he's Asian, or the county attorney in the county is Asian. And I don't think anything of that. So I go into court, the judge is African-American, the opposing attorney is African-American, I don't think anything of it. The bailiff is African-American, no big deal, the court reporter is African-American. The jurors all happen to be African-American. I honestly wouldn't think anything of it, because that, it's kind of unusual that this one day they're all African-American. But that's just a little statistical anomaly. But then the next day, I come back. I'm there for another reason, and there's a different judge there, and he's also African American. And lo and behold, the opposing attorney is also African American, as is the bailiff and the court reporter and the jury and everybody in the court office. And then finally, after a few days, I realize that I'm the only white guy there. everybody else in the courthouse, even though a large percentage of the population is white, for some reason there's never a white judge or white anybody. You know, everybody's always the same color. Well, I'm not, you know, like I said, I don't think there are any racist judges in the county. And I can point at all those judges and say, no, that's a fair judge. That's a good judge that I got today. He happens to be black, but I know that's a good judge, a fair judge. He's going to rule based on the evidence, not for any other reason. And that's true of everybody else. The bailiff is going to, his race has nothing to do with his job. The court reporter is going to get down every word just right, regardless of the color of their skin. So I can't point to any of those people and say that person is biased against me because of their race. But on the other hand, if that happened to be every single day, after a while, that would kind of start to freak me out a little bit. So I've kind of grudgingly come to the conclusion that, when we appoint a judge, we ought to appoint the most qualified person for the job. But maybe as Governor Perpich and President Reagan decided back in the 70s and 80s, well, maybe that person's gender is one of the things that makes them the most qualified person for the job. Or maybe that person's race is one of the things that makes them the best person for the job. Because in Anoka County, an African-American litigant would have exactly the same experience that I just described. Because as they pointed out here, there are 43 judges in that district, and of those 43 judges, 42 of them are white. There's only one minority of all those. So the African American in Anoka County, even though the population of Anoka County is not 42/43 white, that's what he's going to face. So like I say, I've come around a little bit on that topic. It's not exactly affirmative action, but maybe that is one of the things that makes that person the most qualified person for the job. Well, I see we are up on an hour. While I still have the recording on here, I'll pause briefly for any questions from the audience. Well, and hearing none, I'll thank you for joining me today. For your podcast viewers, that second code word that I always forget about. Good thing I remembered here at the last second. The second code number for this portion of the program is B143. B143. B as in bias, 143. And we'll pick it up on part two of this program.